Good afternoon. My name is Myron Aloukian, and this is a difficult presentation for me to give. I gave it something similar once before, and sometimes it triggers me, but I'll do the best I can. So if I break in the middle of it, you'll know why. I served with the 3rd Marine Division in Vietnam in 1965. I was a dentist there, and I was when I landed in the Da Nang Air Force Base, I had been in Okinawa, and when I landed at the Da Nang Air Force Base, it was like walking into a hot oven. From where our plane landed, as you look outside the base, there are maybe 12 tall fences of barbed wire, machine gun nests, towers, mortars set up. And I said to myself, I wasn't thrilled about going to Vietnam. That was in March. It was when the president called the first Marines to go to Vietnam as a fighting force. I was not happy about going, but I went. Because I had seen the Marines coming back and was treating them. They were very excited about going. When they came back, they were different human beings. So landing at the airport and looking out, I said, well, I'll be pretty safe here, you know, lots of protection. And they said, Dr. Lukian, you're not going to be here. You're going to be at the Marine Field Hospital. And I said to myself, oh, I'm going to be at the hospital. That would be even safer than the Air Force Base. I was very naive. So they drove us out into some rice paddies, a bunch of tents in the ground in the middle of these rice paddies that were dried out. And I said, what's that? They said, that's the hospital. And I was kind of in shock because there was one fence 2.5 feet high of barbed wire to keep out animals. And it was a mountain on one side that someone could put a machine gun nest and wipe everyone out. And I said, this is not a good situation. After being there 1 week, I said to myself, well, this is like camping out. It's not that bad. It was relatively quiet, very hot, but quiet. And in the middle of the night, the chopper started going, bup, 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 bup. The chopper's trying to land, and my tent's going like this. I was in a two-man tent. And I said, what the heck is that? And it was our first mass casualties. Maybe 30 or 40 young kids, 18, 19, 20, number of them killed, number of them badly shot up. And there were only 3 physicians and 14 dentists. This was at the 3rd Marine Division Field Hospital where all the mass casualties were supposed to go. So we were deeply involved in keeping these kids alive and helping them keep their lives and all, and stabilizing. We learned that these mass casualties, many of them got shot or killed as they were running from where they were sleeping to their foxholes 20 or 30 feet or yards away. So after we cleaned them all up and stabilized them about 9 o'clock in the morning, we all dug our foxholes right next to our cots. We also learned that in a firefight after this, a number of the VC who were killed were the Vietnamese who were coming in during the day. The barber, the fellow shining shoes, the laundry folks. So from that point on, the Marines never let the Vietnamese on the Marine bases. And from that point on, life was never the same. So we would get periodic mass casualties. They always came in the middle of the night, 1, 2, 3 in the morning. We were sound asleep. And it was just so simplistic. The logistics and the support we had. I said to myself, gee, we're the richest country in the world, and this is how we take care. Of our young kids. As a dentist, we treated patients in the morning, and the Marines are very tough. If they're shot up, they don't come in unless they're ordered to, they're really bad off. But if they had a toothache, they came in. Because if you have a toothache, you can't sleep, you can't eat, you can't do anything. So they came in when they had toothaches and dental problems. The other thing is if they had dentures, and the dentures got broke in a firefight, they couldn't eat, so they had to come in. So we had a lot of kids who needed treatment. Now, we had two high-speed drills, which broke down because of the heat and the dust. And the dental clinic is, it's on the ground. You know, everything's on the ground. We were up, we had some wood underneath us, but everything's breaking down. There's dust everywhere. We're in tents, and it gets very hot. By noontime, it's so hot you couldn't treat the patients because you're just pouring sweat. So I was free every afternoon. And as a result of that freedom, I said, is there something I can do in this community? So what I'm going to talk about today is some of the things we did at the field hospital. I'm going to talk a little bit about the number of casualties in Vietnam. Going to talk a little bit about when I went back in 1990 as a guest of the Minister of Health of Vietnam. I was then the APHA president, and I took my 12-year-old son. It was a very unusual experience because I was very negative about the Vietnam War. One, about the war, but two, you know, I bought the U.S. argument that we should be there. And when I was going as APHA president, I said, they're not going to turn me around. But when I saw what happened, I was turned around. Then when I came back, I did a number of things to raise the visibility for the problem. Okay, so we were outside, maybe 7 or 8 miles outside of the Da Nang Air Force Base. I was with the 3rd Dental Company, but it was the 3rd Marine Division Field Hospital where all the Vietnamese casualties came. They came in by chopper. That's the only way they ever came into us because we had rice paddies all around us. They usually came in the middle of the night. This is after we were there a couple of months where we were able to build a little bridge to it easier to get them to where. The OR was a tent on the ground. We had 2 hours. It was essentially a tent on the dirt ground. While I was there, Hugh O'Brien, Wyatt Earp, came to visit us. And he came after I had been there maybe 4 months. And when you're involved in a situation like that, you're sort of away from the reality of what goes on in the world, and you become hardened or oblivious to what's going on. You just do what you can to keep the kids going. So when I took him around, and I saw how it looked through his eyes, I said, wow, this is horrendous. This is unbelievable. I said, it's unbelievable how we're treating our kids as in terms of providing services. I just saw things very differently. Ted Kennedy came to see us. That's him in the middle on the left. On the right is General Walt, who was head of the Marines at that time, and a reporter, Dickie Chappelle, who also was involved in the Normandy invasion, female, very fantastic reporter. The next day, she went out with 3 Marines. And she got killed from mortar. Went right through her neck and killed her right on the spot. And they brought it back the next day to us. Because we were free in the afternoon, I looked around to see what is it that I could do to help out. And it was a Catholic orphanage. So I went there. I knew a little French from high school. And I said, you know, I'd like to provide care to the kids. Now, Da Nang at that time had a population of about 150 to 200,000 people. They had one formerly trained dentist, a female, who worked mornings only. She saw 60 patients a morning at the hospital. The average dentist sees 60 patients a week. None of these kids had ever had dental care. A lot of them were in pain and suffering. So I first started by myself, and then I was able to get other folks to come along. And after we cleaned up those kids, and the nuns were great, we went to the Buddhist orphanage. I said, are there any other orphanages? And I was told there was a Buddhist orphanage. So I met with them and I said, you know, I'd like to come in and help provide care to the kids. And they said, why do you want to do that? I said, well, why not? They said, well, the Americans never helped the Buddhists. They only helped the Catholics. I said, well, and I had to meet with the top female Buddhist leader of Vietnam because this was so unusual. I said, you know, I don't care what the kids are. I just want to get them out of pain. So we did go to the Buddhist orphanage, and we got the Buddhist Boy Scouts to help us, and we were very efficient and effective in treating the kids. That's me without a beard on the right, holding one of the kids. And we treated a lot of kids and got them out of pain, and they loved us because we gave them a quality of life they couldn't have. In the lower right is the kids at the Buddhist orphanage. At the end of the day, after we treated them, they'd sing a thank you song. And I said to myself, this is the kind of dentist I want to be, where you make a difference in people's lives because no one else is providing them services. So I came back to the United States thinking I'd work in developing countries. When I met with a number of people, they said, why don't you get training in public health? I said, what's public health? I didn't have a clue. Long story short, I ended up at Harvard for 3 years studying public health, and that changed my life also. But an interesting thing is when I did come back and I got my training at Harvard, they were having a hearing on fluoridation. And they asked me if I would speak because I had been going to boards of health talking to them about fluoridation. And I couldn't understand why they would ask me as a graduate student to speak when they had the health commissioner and the head of the dental society and the medical society and the head of Mass General Hospital all speaking. And I put some data together. When I did that, I found that Massachusetts teenagers had 6 times more tooth decay than Vietnamese teenagers. 6 times more tooth decay, Massachusetts teenagers versus Vietnamese. 3 dental schools in Boston. The average 16-year-old in Massachusetts then had 15 cavities. The Vietnamese kids had only about 2 or 3. Of course, you know, we eat sugar. They don't. So I ended up staying in public health, became the city dental director, and that's a whole other story. But it's because of those kids in Vietnam that I ended up getting training in public health and have been involved. We also went to the refugee camps, and in the refugee camps, you would have 10 to 15 people living on one room, enormous, enormous dental needs. We went to the villages. We went to this one village where they were building a Buddhist temple, and they were so thrilled that we were coming. They had the equivalent of a ticker tape parade on Fifth Avenue, with the banners, welcome dentists, doctors, people all lined up along the street. It was just an unbelievable reception because we were getting them out of pain and affection and providing a service they didn't have. I also used to drive out to Lamai, a village about 12 or 15 miles from our base. It was beyond the safety zone. And I'd go with a dental technician who carried the rifle, and I'd drive the Jeep because I loved driving the Jeep in the mud, in the sand. And I was very naive at the time because I'd be driving down the road, and on the side there'd be a bunch of Marines on a search and destroy mission, the village. And I'm going out to provide dental care, and they're searching and destroying, you know. In those days they burned the village to save it. Lucky nothing ever happened to me, but I wouldn't do that again, but at that time I did that sort of thing. This is at the refugee camp. We had a reporter come from the armed services. He did a story on us after about 5 or 6 months there, and unknown to me, we started this on our own, and after we were doing it 2 or 3 months, the White House got a people-to-people program going in Vietnam. And my weekly reports were going right to the White House because they were trying to show the American people that we're helping people there. which I didn't realize until I learned that much later. The Vietnam War, we had more tons of explosives in Vietnam than World War I and World War II combined. About 10 million war victims, 19 million gallons of Agent Orange, and that Agent Orange affected a landmass of roughly 5 million acres, which is about the size of Massachusetts. Just unbelievable destruction. There are various estimates on the number of people killed in Vietnam. I've heard them from 3 million to 8 million. But let's say it was 5 million Vietnamese that were killed, mostly civilians. 14% of the population. That would be equivalent to 45 million Americans getting killed. Can you imagine 45 million Americans getting killed over a period of time? We lose about 2.5 million Americans a year from deaths in general, 600,000 from heart disease, maybe 490,000-500,000 from cancer. 14% of their population were killed in that war. Unbelievable, devastating. In terms of our own troops, we had over 58,000 deaths, about 2.5 to over 3.5 Americans served in the war. At least 700,000 had PTSD. Over 10,000 lost at least one limb, more than Korea. And interestingly, in MIAs, there are about 2,200 in 1993. The Vietnamese had over 300,000 MIAs in their own country. And our country made it a political agenda that the Vietnamese are hiding or keeping U.S. military there, and we play that over and over and over to squeeze them. Whereas in World War II, we had 78,000 MIAs, and in Korea, we had 8,000 MIAs. And that war cost us over $500 billion. In World War II, we had 465,000 American deaths. In the Civil War, we had 620,000. And in, just to put things in perspective, in Afghanistan and Iraq, we have over 4,000. The population when I was there in 1965 was 34 million. In 1975, when we left, it was 43 million. In 1990, when I went back, it was 65 million. When I went back in 1990, and I told you I took my oldest son, who was 12, I was expecting the Vietnamese people to be very angry at us and upset. But they were very, very friendly and warm toward me and my son. And I said, you know, how come? And I went with I was sent by the Joyner Foundation in Boston. I had an interpreter and I had a reporter from the Washington Post because I was APHA president. And talking to the people on the street, I said, why are people so nice to us? Why are they so friendly? And the answer was, because you are of the American people. It was the American people who stopped their government from this war. You had a bad government. And we thank the American people for stopping this war. Very touching. Very touching. Interestingly, today, there are about 1.5 million Vietnamese living in the United States. LBJ did not run for president as a result of the Vietnam War. He started Medicare and Medicaid and the War on Poverty. And I say because of the Vietnam War and that war of poverty, poverty won. Because of the distraction of the Vietnam War, many of those programs and policies, which had a great constituency before we got deeply involved in the Vietnam War, became worked against him as protesters about the war, and he lost the support of the American people. And that's unfortunate. I mean, Medicare and Medicaid has been great for our country, Head Start, all of those programs, community health centers. But because of the Vietnam War, we really lost the war on poverty as a nation. Can you imagine if we had that $500 billion going into these programs rather than Vietnam, what a difference we'd be today? And we probably would have had a national health program much sooner than we had today. When we went there in 1990, 43% of the population was born after the war ended, after the U.S. left Vietnam. In 1990, the per capita income was $150 a year. Now, why are things so bad? Well, after we left Vietnam, we imposed a trade embargo on Vietnam, so they could not get any goods or services into Vietnam. They used to be one of the most productive countries in the world with rice. They were producing three crops of rice a year. As a result of the war and as a result of the trade embargo, they had problems with food, supplies, medications, medical textbooks. Everything stood still once the trade embargo began. And when I was there, we found a lot of malnourishment among the children, thanks to the U.S. trade embargo. And these are kids who had nothing to do with the war. They're born after the war, and we had a trade embargo that's injuring young kids. Had nothing to do with the war at all. That was the policy of our country for 20 years until that trade embargo was lifted in 1995 under the Clinton administration. I don't think the American people are aware of what we were doing, what these trade embargoes mean. As a result of my visit to Vietnam in 1990, and we went to the major cities, Hue, Saigon, Da Nang, and Hanoi. I went to the hospital, the main hospital in Hanoi, which had been bombed, Bach Mai Hospital. We bombed it three times. President Nixon said, it's communist propaganda. Bombs can drop on a dime, lying to the American people. When I was there, they showed me the photographs. They showed me the wards that were blown up. They showed me the casualties, people in hospitals who were wounded or injured or killed again from our bombs on Bach Mai Hospital. But as a result of that visit, my view of what we did in Vietnam changed dramatically. I did a lot of research after when I came back. I went to congressional tapes. I went into the literature. I ended up writing an open letter to President Bush as APHA president, asking for normalization of relations, and we provide better aid, humanitarian aid to Vietnam, which no one was doing as a result of the trade embargo, and then better services for U.S. I got responses from Senator Kennedy. Jim Mason was then the Assistant Secretary for Health, the former head of CDC. We had that printed in the Journal of Public Health Policy, the Harvard Dental Bulletin did a story on it. We got a resolution through APHA on the consequences of the Vietnam War, and that was also adopted by the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Vic Seidel, who was then in a leadership came to me. He says, Myron, can we use the same wording you used at APHA? I said, sure, and they did that. Then at APHA, we had a number of sessions on war by Barry Levy and Vic Seidel, and then they ended up writing a book on public health, on war and public health, which is in its second edition, which is you know, to me, you know, there's so many public health consequences of war that we really don't think about, and we as a society do not acknowledge, especially for the young, especially for civilians, especially for the elderly. In 1965, the life expectancy in Vietnam was, for men it was 49 years. For women it was 57. In 1989, the life expectancy for men was 62, 65 for women. And in 2013, it was roughly 71 years for men and women and 76 years, but an enormous increase over time. When you look at per capita income, in that first line, $150. Today it's over $5,000. And the amount of money for health in 1990 when I was there was about a dollar. $1 per person per year for health in Vietnam. Well, that's a quick overview of my experiences in Vietnam and what happened, has happened since. We have veterans still from Vietnam who have PTSD, and their death rate is twice that of the general population. We have emerging problems from Agent Orange that are still being documented. The economy in Vietnam has improved dramatically since we discontinued the trade embargo, but we still need to do the research and the studies and to educate people of the ramifications of this war. I was very upset when we went into Iraq. I thought it was the stupidest thing we could do as a country. And at when we first went in, everyone thought it was a great idea. And I was speaking at a fundraiser for the Fenway Health Center, which is its focus population is the gay community. And it was a luncheon. And I think it was a day or two after we invaded Iraq, and I got up in front of maybe 300 or 400 people. And when you're a Vietnam veteran, you can say things that you can't if you're not. And I said the stupidest thing we did was to go into Iraq. And when I gave the explanation, first of all, people were shocked. Then when I explained why, you know, I could see the head shaking. And people came to me and said, you're very brave to say that. And that's what we do in public health. We speak up for people that no one else speaks up for. We are the voice of the voiceless. We do things for the underserved and those who are not served. And you have to speak up. You have to have the data. You have to educate. And that's how you make change. You need to develop a constituency, but you don't get up. You don't give up. You keep yelling and screaming and developing support till you do what's right for the people of our country and the people of other countries as well. Thank you.